Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 85 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Bond, Jennifer Bond, licensed account for the USDA Economic Research Service. Bond's title is Senior Economist and Coordinator of the Wheat and Pulse Program at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She is one of the PhD-trained economists at USDA who develop and analyze the data that makes up the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate, referred to by its acronym WASD. It's the everything you want to know about wheat, rice, feed grains, oilseeds, cotton, sugar, meat animals, poultry, and dairy supplies in the U.S. and around the world. The last report was released July 12th. Google WASD, W-A-S-D-E, and you'll quickly discover the importance the USDA puts on knowing what's going on with agricultural production, supply and demand, and global consumption. Bond and I talk ahead about the WASD report, which is also one of the ingredients that helps set prices for Pacific Northwest wheat farmers and is essential to companies that use any of the 9 agricultural commodities I mentioned above. Of course, investors and speculators also use the information, which no doubt results in billions of dollars of profit or loss. Bond is a Washington State gal from Mercer Island, where a love of riding horses introduced her to the natural world and a career in ag economics. 7 years ago, she was on a trajectory to become a tenured professor at Colorado State University, where her husband was also an academic. Although the couple has 2 children, they were booked with the demands of managing graduate students, attending meetings, teaching, extension, and research. Change was in the air. I got the feeling from talking with Bond that there was a time she might have felt snobby about the academic life. I understand. All these years after my own college education, I still hold professors in high regards. Obtaining a PhD is no small feat, and getting a job at a university is a little like grasping the gold ring. So I was surprised there is another side to the ivory tower story. That is, being too busy to enjoy it. 6 years ago, Bond and her husband and children departed Colorado. He now works as an economist for the RAND Corporation. Though their work is still demanding, I got the feeling that the real pressure cooker was university life, not Washington, D.C. life. Bond, who was holding meetings in Eastern Washington, visited the Washington Grain Commission office on June 25th, where I interviewed her for this podcast. I'm not sure I have ever interviewed a woman economist before. She not only knew her subject, she spoke in complete paragraphs. Heaven for a podcaster. As you heard, part of Bond's title includes oversight of the pulse industry, and I devote about the last third of the podcast to her interesting observations on this important group of rotational crops in the Northwest. But first, as is my nature, I wanted to learn more about the human equation. I asked Bond about the demographic of her workplace and what it was like to work around a bunch of economists.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I'm sure not a lot of that probably comes through in our reports. We don't have a picture of ourselves with those reports, for example. I will say that I do work primarily with men in the crops branch. There are a few other senior economists, and they are all men in their 50s and 60s. And there are some women who come in. There's a few that have been junior analysts. There tends to be some movement around the different agencies. We call that rearranging the deck chairs. And so we've had, you know, some turnover there. There's lots of opportunities for young economists in D.C. And so it would be nice to be able to really hold on to them and develop the skill set so that there's continuity in case anyone retires. But I would say it's a very friendly place to work. Last week, I coordinated an Ag Scholars meeting. We had like 14 different students from various Ag Econ programs throughout the country. My colleagues came together and shared their stories, and we had a wonderful time, you know, sort of reconnecting. We're all very busy, though. We do a lot of work over at the South Building, so we don't always get a chance to see each other. So it is a little bit of a different work environment than if you were in a regular office where you saw people constantly.
Mm-hmm. And what's a typical day look like to you? Are you sitting in front of a computer for 8 hours?
Sometimes more. I will say that the nature of the work is very cyclical. I work in the Outlook program, and so we're closely connected to the WASDE report cycle. So myself and the other coordinators also on the interagency committee. So we're over at the South Building for a good 2 weeks every month working on that process. So during that process, we wake up, gather information, put together some analysis and so on that we can bring to the meetings and share with each other, gather data, address stakeholders' calls, emails, that kind of thing. We all do research as well, and especially this time of year, we really try to make some inroads on the research projects as we're coming up on the end of the fiscal year, so we have some deadlines there. So when I'm not working on the Outlook and the WASDE and the associated data products, I'm really trying to put together research projects.
Okay, I've been accused of using acronyms on this podcast.
Explain
what WASDE is.
The WASDE is, I would say, USDA's sort of premier report.
Okay, but you're going to have to spell it out.
Definitely. It's the World Egg Supply and Demand Estimates. So it's the balance sheets for various commodities. Most importantly, probably for your audience, for the U.S., for wheat, feed grains, rice, sugar sweeteners, but also for other countries in the world, too.
Do you get assigned the crops you work on, or can you ask to work on a specific crop? And how did you come to be one of those who write about wheat?
At ERS, our staff has been shrinking a fair bit over the years, even since I've been there. So there's a lot of breadth of coverage, perhaps not a lot of depth. So it's very difficult to ask someone to take on an additional crop. Most people are covering a couple. And so we're covering bases as people have retired or as people are training. Folks that have been there a little while perhaps provide some additional coverage. Such was the case for my getting involved in wheat. The gentleman that had been covering wheat for more than a decade, Gary Vokey, is an institution, announced that he was going to retire. So I flexed out of feed grains and pollinator coverage to learn, to mentor under him, so that I could provide the continuity when he left. And it took some time, actually, after he left before they hired someone new. And so it was a good situation to be able to have someone that could come in and say something about wheat in that absence. And for other crops, too, I think there are sort of similar situations in place. But I wouldn't say that there's a lot of redundancy there. I don't think there's a lot of people that have a bunch of folks covering wheats. I think you mentioned that on the wheat team, there's actually two of us that routinely work on it, but we really have kind of divided up the activities. So I cover domestic plus U.S. and Canada, and my partner Ogle Leifer covers a lot of the rest of the world, too. It would be a really large job to be trying to keep track of all the balance sheets for all those countries, so I'm grateful that I've got a partner to assist with that.
So what's the best part of your job?
I think the best part of my job is when we've anticipated market movements correctly, especially major market movements. That's always pretty satisfying. One of the projects that we're involved in is putting together the out-year baseline balance sheet, so going out 10 years, with a real emphasis on the next marketing year. That information is a component into a project by the Congressional Budget Office. And so that's a big series of meetings in the fall. And we have purview on planted area, for example, which is a real controversial number. And we had suggested that acreage might go up this year. There are some indications of positivity. And lo and behold, we did see some improvements in some various areas. So that's gratifying. I would also say when stakeholders call and they have something positive to say where we've made a difference for them, where we've been able to clarify something, I find that very gratifying. We don't always get calls like that, but I do appreciate it when they come in.
And those stakeholders, they would be...
You know, I do get calls from farmers occasionally. Oftentimes I get calls from other analysts. A fair number of financial institutions also reach out to us. A lot of traders, for example, but also university faculty. So I work with folks at Oklahoma State, Montana State, and other places. We work on balance sheets together and Outlook. And so that's been a rewarding experience.
Now, how many years have you been in this particular position?
Goodness, I think I started winter of 2015. So was that about 2.5 years thereabouts?
Mm-hmm. And how mm-hmm. many years in total with the agency?
Almost 6 years to the day.
All right.
Yeah.
So it's rare, but occasionally I make an error in my job. do you ever make errors? And are errors always caught before a report is published?
To human is to err, I think. So indeed, we do make some mistakes. We really try to minimize that. There is an extensive review process, but I feel like it is almost unavoidable at times until robots replace me and my job. And when that does happen, you immediately need to do a mea culpa because people rely on these numbers. So we issue something called an errata and a correction. And it's humbling because when you have to do that, it goes all the way up to our administrator and you have to write an explanation and you need to explain yourself and come up with a way to try to not have that happen again. So it's been a while, knock on wood, since we've had a wheat errata. And I'm hopeful it'll be a long time before we have one again.
Do folks in your office pay attention to analysts outside the USDA who are constantly second-guessing your numbers?
I believe so. Speaking from my own personal experience, there's a small group of people that cover wheat by class, that report on wheat by class, and many of them have decades of experience. I'm relatively new to wheat by class. And so I value their perspectives, but take it with a grain of salt, too, because sometimes people have their own perspective. You know, they're sitting in Nebraska or Kansas or Washington, and they're seeing what's happening around them. And my job is to try to take a look at the U.S. as a whole. So I try to synthesize that information and be respectful. I'm certain that there are other analysts, too, that have regular contacts that they value. We subscribe to an awful lot of newsletters, those kind of things, from those individuals. And I'm glad that we can provide them a set of numbers that they then, too, can poke holes in. So It's a mutually beneficial relationship, I think.
And you essentially provide the benchmark for those analysts to poke holes in.
I think USDA has a reputation for providing a benchmark. We have access to some data that perhaps they don't feel is available publicly to them, perhaps from NASS, maybe a little bit sooner than some of the publicly released data. Perhaps we provide it in a different format. I think I've used the term synthesis a couple times in this discussion. I think that's something that we contribute and is appreciated. So being able to synthesize data across various agencies, across various states and across the globe, and to put out numbers that make sense and have some internal consistency is, I think, where a lot of that value comes from.
I recently had an analyst tell me that the recent export numbers that the USDA released are off and are less than your report indicated. To an outsider, it would seem that export numbers are black and white. Is that not the case?
I'm glad you asked about this question because we do get inquiries about the export figures. Whereas for imports, there's a number of what we call HS codes that describe the products that are coming into the country from other places, and those relate to different classes. For exports, it's a little more opaque. There's fewer codes, and so there's always been a bit more nebulousness around exports than imports. And there are also multiple sources of data to consider as well. So there are sales and donations data, which we get, and there's also inspections data. And so people have different preferences. The inspections data tends to have a little bit more detail. The sales and donations data is what I input into my system, and in combination with the work from the Foreign Ag Service, we develop our set of estimates. Perhaps those are a little bit ahead of pace of what your individual was seeing. We constantly update those, and I think that there's sometimes an awareness, too, of when there might be movement in a market, and we try to internalize all that information, keeping in mind that we're putting out an annual, like a marketing year estimate, as opposed to this month, that month, et cetera. So we're really trying to take a longer-term perspective.
I have a farmer friend who sends me his analyst's newsletter, and it almost seems as if this particular analyst believes that USDA has an axe to grind, that they are pushing the prices one way or the other. How do you respond to that?
That is unfortunate. I can tell you, I work with a bunch of high integrity people, and there is absolutely no interest in manipulating markets, the absence of. A lot of work bending over backwards to make sure that we are considering everything that is relevant. We have a number of different price models that we have been using for a long time, too, and updating as new data becomes available. So there's definitely no intention to game the market. There's no gain from that. None of us benefit financially or otherwise from having a price that's off. What we benefit from is building a reputation for having accurate prices. That's what we like. So everyone has got the intention of putting the correct price out there.
But you are familiar with the fact that there are people out there who believe that USDA is gaming the system somehow.
I mean, I suppose I've heard criticism from various folks over time about various balance sheet figures. And this is where I caution, you know, against the myopic perspective. I mean, we are considering all wheat. You know, the all wheat balance sheet for 2018-19 is what's published right now. We'll put out wheat by class, you know, this next month, and so we can talk more about some of that nuance there. But right now, there's all wheat. That's a lot of wheat, a lot of classes to consider, a lot of markets. And our best information right now is that the price is what it is reported in the WASD. There's been upward momentum in prices for corn, for example, and so that's reflected in our latest figures as well. Upward momentum in prices for, you know, various classes as well, and that impacts.
How does the current tariff rhetoric affect the numbers, or does it?
So when we are forecasting imports or exports, we are required to consider the situation of the status quo. So not to project on any tariffs that might happen, but really just think about what is currently going on. Certainly we're aware of it, you know, and considering those different things, but those are not going to be reflected into our figures, our forecasts, especially baseline, until those become a reality.
Okay. We're told that China holds 50% of the world's wheat stocks. How do we know that China holds 50% of the world's wheat stocks?
That's a great question, and I think it's probably drawing inference from what is observable, from market movements, perhaps observing storage facilities. But I don't know that that's known with certainty, and certainly their government, I don't believe, has reported on that number specifically.
What's the USDA philosophy when it comes to numbers coming from countries that are more opaque? That they're better than nothing?
I think they're even better than that. I think those countries have come to rely on USDA statistics in some cases. And even countries where you would expect their statistics to be fairly robust appreciate having access to the USDA data too, because it's another perspective. In some cases, the countries just don't have the statistical expertise, the depth of personnel that we have at USDA. And so I think that they appreciate it, and certainly it is better than nothing. But I think it's actually a fairly robust assessment of what's going on in those countries. And even little countries, it's important to try to get a handle on what's going on there, because those little countries aggregated can make a real difference in the world balance sheets and tell a story about what is evolving in wheat markets in the globe.
So you're telling me that another country looks forward to USDA reports because they tell something about the country that the country itself doesn't know, perhaps?
I think that's absolutely the case. Sure. I mean, in some cases, they really just don't have the boots on the ground, the statistical resources to go out and do an assessment within their country. And it may be that they, you know, quibble with that, but we're still providing a forecast and it's substantiated.
So the U.S. does not have the lowest cost of wheat in the world. What does the U.S. have going for it when it comes to wheat exports?
Correct. And we've seen that impact our share of global trade. That's been declining over time. Demand for wheat in the globe is increasing, though. And that potentially provides some upward momentum for U.S. wheat. Folks around the world can be price sensitive, but U.S. wheat has a reputation for being high quality. There are non-trivial transportation costs to also consider. There might be relatively cheap wheat in Russia, but it's awfully expensive to get it potentially to a place like Mexico, whereas we're right across the border. So there's some logistical advantages, and as I mentioned, quality as well. And wheat, as your audience certainly knows, is not homogeneous. It's a differentiated crop. There's demand for different classes of wheat and established trade relationships that can help to maintain demand for U.S. wheat in foreign markets, even when the price has got some upward momentum on it.
Mm-hmm. So you have also worked the pulse beet, or the crops that we call peas, lentils, chickpeas.
Yes. I
did a podcast, episode 40, where the director of the USA Dry Pea and Lentil Council suggested that pulse protein sources are going to take off. What do the numbers indicate?
I'm really glad that you did a podcast on that topic. I think that there's increasing interest in pulses in the marketplace and not a whole lot of information out there. Pulses, your listeners may know, pulses include like dry beans, dry peas, and lentils. And I coordinate the balance sheets for all of those crops. For beans, it's dozens of different varieties. But for dry pea and lentils, which is what your visitor was probably speaking to, indeed, we have seen increase in per capita availability of those crops over the last 5 years. In 2010-11, per capita availability of dry peas was a little more than half a pound. And for the 17-18 marketing year, it's currently forecast at more than a pound and a half. That is a residual, if you will, from other balance sheet categories and also reflects reduced exports. There are some things going on in the world marketplace, in particular the India market, that's reducing opportunities for North American dry pea and lentils. So that creates more domestic supply. Well, consumers do seem to be consuming more of those. Perhaps that's because it's available or because it's demand. I can't say with authority which one it is. We can say that this increase in per capita availability parallels a period of time where we have observed the gluten-free trend really taking root. Some would argue that we're at peak gluten-free trend, but certainly that trend opened up opportunities in the marketplace for snack products in particular that didn't contain gluten. And one source of flour would be like dry pea flour. And so perhaps that is behind that increase in that per capita availability. Plantings for dry peas haven't necessarily increased a whole lot over the last couple of years. And in the 18-19 marketing year, we're projecting plantings for dry peas to be about level year to year. So the increase in per capita availability has not necessarily led to increased plantings. In contrast, for lentils, there's been a pretty significant increase in plantings in correspondence with an increase in per capita availability. Exports for lentils had been on the upswing, but now with the developments in India, we saw a little bit of a retrenchment this last year. It's possible that we'll see improvement in the future. That depends a lot on whether the tariffs that were imposed are rolled back.
And what about chickpeas, or what the farmers call garbs?
That's right. Yeah, garbanzo beans or chickpeas, the term is used interchangeably. Certainly, there's been an increase in demand for chickpeas, at least as indicated by the per capita availability. We've seen tremendous increase in planted area. I've written pretty extensively on this for the Vegetable and Pulses Outlook. It's been an exciting trend to follow. And while we don't track retail sales, we're more focused at the farm gate. Certainly observing the increase in plantings indicates that there is some interest there. And prices have stayed robust, even as production has generally increased. Previous year, there were some challenges with weather that led to perhaps a smaller production than we anticipated. But prices have generally stayed pretty robust. So that does perhaps indicate there's demand there that is supporting prices. Consumers know, they go to the grocery store and you see an awful lot of hummus in the marketplace.
What about pulses for pet food? Is that something that you follow?
Use for pet food would show up in our feed and residual category. And that's a little bit challenging. Anytime we try to forecast feed and residual is a challenge. We don't have a NAS survey that goes out and objectively collects information on what feed compounders are utilizing. So it's a function more of ending stocks and other factors in some models. So it's difficult to say precisely how much pulses are going into food. But certainly we've heard that. We've heard that from the industry as well. And I have also heard that pet food trends tend to emulate human food trends too. So it would not surprise me if we saw more dry peas, lentils, and possibly beans too showing up in your dog food.
Certainly, if pulses become a bigger part of the pet food market, you can bet that Bond and USDA professionals like her will be using, as she put it in a portion of the interview that was cut, math and economics as tools to explain the phenomenon. USDA keeps a close eye on agricultural production around the world for a reason. People must be fed, and if they aren't, well then, bad things happen. One example, researchers believe the civil war in Syria was sparked as a consequence of drought in the country that forced farmers into cities without enough to eat, or do for that matter. Although tariff issues are hamstringing various agricultural commodity exports and reducing prices in the U.S., the July 12th WASD report had some good news. It estimated that global wheat production will fall 3% in the 2018-2019 marketing year, the first drop in 5 years. Meanwhile, the USDA report forecasts global wheat consumption to outpace production by 12.6 million metric tons, dropping the global stocks-to-use ratio for wheat to levels not seen since 2007-2008. Back in my other life as a reporter, I remember thinking if I had it to do over again, I'd go back to school to become an agricultural economist. You see, while agriculture may not appear to be at the center of everything, it is. Because everything we have accomplished as a species can ultimately be traced back to agriculture. It is, after all, the only essential industry on the planet. Please join me again next time for another episode of Weed All About It.
We love the land. The farm's our career. But make no mistake, we do not steer. Mother Nature's in the driver's seat. I'm talking life, and I'm talking wheat. We're riding shotgun, and we have our say. But Mrs. N, she points the way. We feed you.